Welcome to KBOOP, Prerna Gupta.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, congratulations on the release of the new book, Making the Unseen Visible, Science and the Contested Histories of Radiation Exposure, a collection of essays in which you are a contributing author. Your chapter looks at uranium mining in India and public attitudes about the risks posed by nuclear mining and technologies, and you draw on your research as a PhD student at the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of British Columbia, and data you collected in India for your thesis. But let's start with the overall scope of the book before turning to your own research. Can you talk about what drew this group of scholars together around the topic of contested histories of radiation?
Yeah, thank you so much. It is quite exciting to see the book come together. This project has largely been spearheaded by historian Jacob Hamlin and Linda Richards, who are both professors at the Oregon State University. There, they are also leading a project. This book was because of a workshop that they do every year, which is known as Ways of Knowing Radiation. And every year they bring together scholars from all around the world talking about histories of exposure to radiation from different nuclear facilities.
And ways of looking at radiation. So that's a term that often is associated with critical perspectives, bringing another vantage point or lens on a problem that's already been taken up by researchers. What did you bring as authors to this? It seems that it was both a research project, but one guided by social justice interests in marginalized communities, groups that have been affected by radiation exposure that often are on the periphery of what researchers generally take up.
So, as the in the very introduction of the book, the problem of talking about radiation exposure is brought forward, which is that it is an invisible thing, and the effects of radiation or effects from other kind of contamination that happens from nuclear facilities takes a long time before it becomes visible on
And
people.
that is a property of radiation.
That is a property of radiation. Yeah. So that poses a big problem to do research on this topic. And many times, adequate measures are not taken by the industry that is producing this kind of pollution or this kind of radiation and the impacts that it's having on people. So it is left up to a lot of independent researchers to try to bring together how we might think of the impacts from nuclear facilities. And one way to do that, which the OSU project also looks into, is oral history. So recording people's testimonies over time of how they have observed health impacts on their own bodies and what they have observed in environment around them.
Everyday people are close observers of their environment and operate with some scientific principles in mind. And I'd like to ask you more about that as it relates to your research as well, but wanted to have you just say a bit about the editors of the volume. As you mentioned earlier, Jacob Darwin Hamblin and Linda Richards are faculty at Oregon State University and part of the Oregon State University Downwinders Project. Can you just describe what that project is? Because I think that will interest many people in the book as well.
So the Hanford Nuclear Reservation litigation, or the Downwinders case, is one of the most controversial legal struggles in the history of atomic energy. And the work of this group is basically it has two distinct goals. The first focuses on developing an important research collection, which includes recently acquired Berger-Haber Hanford Nuclear Reservation Downwinders case collection, working in collaboration with the Special Collections and Archives Research Center of the Oregon State University. So this involves digitizing a portion of this collection and supplementing it with the oral history interviews. And the second goal is to produce the first detailed historical studies of the DOES reconstruction project. So linking it to the issues in the history of science, environmental history, and the broad field of science and technology studies.
And there's a film out now called Downwinders that takes up some of that same work and bringing in oral history and everyday people as observers and as involved in documenting the effects of what often remains invisible or less perceptible to researchers. Well, can you describe your research project, which was an ambitious endeavor that took place over many years, as I understand, India, and that you begin your chapter with an area that's interested me for some time as well as a psychologist, the psychology and sociology of risk assessment. And one finding from this, the field of risk research, is that humans are not particularly good at assessing risk. And you kind of take up the gauntlet of that challenge and raise the question, it depends on how you approach the problem and the measures you bring. And so why did you begin there, and what was your orientation to risk assessment? I mean, you do take up some of the lead findings in that field.
Yeah, so a lot of my work is in the risk assessment or risk perception area. So usually what I've seen in this research is that there is a distinction made between what is termed as objective risk assessment by experts and a subjective emotion-laden risk perception by people. And I wanted to kind of question some of the assumptions that are there in this binary that has been posed in the literature. And I'm not the first person to do it. There are other researchers who have also talked about this before. Brian Wynn is one example from UK. So what I set on to do in this paper, I had basically two aims. One aim was to question this binary by kind of extending some arguments related to the case study of uranium mining in India and the health impacts that have been observed. And second was to show that even the actor in this case, which is the Uranium Corporation of India Limited, owned by the government, that poses itself to be objective, to be saying objective truths, is influenced by politics.
And often they are very reassuring in these objective measures, right? And they tend to downplay or gather data in a way that often leads to the findings that are meant to be very reassuring to communities. There's a long history of that with nuclear and other technologies, but the nuclear power industry is famous for its reassuring pronouncements.
Yes. And it's the same in India. There is a section on UCL's website or Nuclear Corporation India's website which says myths of radiation or myths of Jadugoda. Jadugoda is the uranium mine that I explore in the study.
What do they claim to be some examples of myths?
Well, they talk about how the radiation levels, they don't cross permissible limits. They're well within the permissible limits. The fear of people is kind of, you know, not valid. And this is where the politicization happens. They say two things. One is that the most of the diseases that are being observed near these uranium mines in Jadugoda is because of malnutrition, poor health, and unhygienic practices of the people there. And these are indigenous people. So this is a kind of stereotype that exists in the Indian society, and it is used by UCIL to shift the blame back on the people themselves. And the second is that many times they would say that all these stories that are being said about the health impacts are the work of anti-nationals or are the work of people who do not want the development of India's nuclear.
Well, there's probably something to be said for that, that you dig a little deeper when you're critical of an industry, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You don't accept the memo at face value.
Yeah, definitely.
So how do you, I found part of your chapter that was interesting in how you approach the subjective and the dismissal of everyday concerns about uranium mining is how you approach what's called spiritist explanations or spiritual explanations that are often dismissed by researchers as forms of superstition. Can you give some examples? Because you do describe ideas about evil spirits inhabiting the area.
Well, in my opinion, I wasn't trying to come from a spiritist perspective or anything like that. I was merely reporting what people have said what people have observed over a period of time. And yes, in their explanation, so the example I think you might be referring to is there was a tree under which when people would pass, they would say that you'll have a miscarriage. And they thought that this was because there were evil spirits living on that tree. Later, they found out that it was because of some contamination from the uranium mines. So that explanation changed when they understood that uranium mining in the area is causing some pollution, which is leading to some health impacts. But the first way of understanding it was from their own kind of way of knowing, to think about it as some kind of evil spirits. And this is not the only kind of example, you know, like workers observed that, you know, if they were cut by mine rock, wounds will not heal very quickly. It would take a long time for them to heal. Women were having a lot of miscarriages living around the area. So there is a local midwife that says that the number of miscarriages has increased. They were observing kids being born with abnormalities. And farmers were observing that some of the fruits would have deformed seeds, which was increasing over time as well.
So you're saying that there's an initial perception or apperception of disturbing influences on the environment where people draw on kind of ready-made language or meaning system for expressing their disturbance, but then over time can incorporate their knowledge of the material sources of some of these bad effects. That it's, I think you're saying it's not that people who adopt a mystical explanation are somehow unable to also incorporate scientific explanations.
Exactly. That's what I'm trying to say. And also, you know, risk perception is always kind of put into this kind of cognitive model where it is focused on an individual and how an individual has biases or heuristics that lead them to form certain risk perceptions. But as many scholars of risks have argued, so Mary Douglas is one, Brian Wynne is another, that it is not just about your cognitive biases. Risks are made in our social and cultural contexts, and people make sense of them in those contexts as well. So in this example, after UCL has operated for decades, you know, people start understanding what kind of institution this is. And as Brian Wynne talks about people's social experience of risk, of institutions that make risks. And this is even found in psychometric studies, you know, that trust is a big factor in understanding people's risk perception. If you do not trust the institution, you will perceive a higher risk from whatever risk that institution is creating.
And of course, the industry, certainly in the US, has manipulated that finding in various ways to instill trust, to have promotional materials and spokespeople of a status that is believed to cultivate trust. How have moving to the activist side of your project, I know we met last fall at University of British Columbia around both our interest in nuclear power, the industry and its propaganda, but also our interest in activism and social change and civic dialogue. How has that part of your research proceeded in India? What kinds of conversations do you hope to have in anti-nuclear activism there?
Wow, that's a big question. So
the big question here too. doesn't have a happy answer, but we still have to
tackle it. Yeah. So I've been involved with activism around nuclear issues for a while now, both with respect to nuclear weapons, nuclear energy, uranium mining. And my research is motivated by my experience with social movements in India. As a researcher, I believe that I want to position myself in a space that can support social movements or can create a rigorous scholarship that can bring forth the opinions or the ideologies being put forth by social movements. So that's how I see myself as a researcher doing scholarly work. And I feel like, you know, when you're studying medicine or any kind of exact sciences, it is very much accepted that if you study something, you will apply it. But as social scientists, this kind of, if you're studying about society, I don't see why it's a problem that you want to apply it to the society as well, to make it better. And I think that should be one of the goals of any social scientist, to apply what they've learned to make society better.
Yeah, and of course, there are different visions of that, from radical transformative visions that aim to transform capitalism and the patriarchal, heterosexist, racist institutions that it's been built on. And then there are more liberal projects that are more incremental, fighting for reforms here and there when you can. And of course, these go hand in hand. But do you see your work and the civic aspects of it as part of a broader climate justice movement, or where would you place it in that framework in India? It's a hard country, as I understand it, particularly now, to be fighting for social justice and equity as it is here.
Yeah, I think the BJP led the kind of Hindu right-wing government that is in power right now has been curbing any kind of dissent in India. The media, for example, has basically become a propaganda machine for the government. So it is a difficult time, definitely. And sorry, I forgot the second part of the question.
Are there spaces in India area? I mean, it's a very big country and a very complex country in terms of the regions and the political makeup and demographics. Are there places in India where you see more potential for climate justice work that includes this focus on nuclear, but a broader vision of going beyond both carbon and nuclear energy and the militaries that are driving them, but looking for something beyond this ruinous terrain we now inhabit?
Yeah, I think that is my next big question, kind of how to think about environmental issues in India and how to incorporate that into larger, you know, mainstream politics as well. And that is very challenging at the moment. I do have a lot of hope from when it comes to climate change from the young generation. I think they're very vocal about that in India. And India has a rich history of environmental movements as well. The difference that it has from Western countries, the environmental movements in Western countries, is that in India, all environmental movements are also social movements. It is always connected to the questions of land and livelihood as well. So if you take, for example, the anti-dam movement in central part of India, known as the Narmada Bachao movement, the biggest questions, yes, ecology was important, but also for people, displacement that was going to happen because of the dams, how it was going to impact their traditional livelihoods. And because how dependent people, a lot of people are still on nature, on forests, on kind of the richness of the land, these questions become both environmental and social at the same time. And so I think if we have to talk about environmental issues in India, we have to see it from that lens.
Well, I look forward to hearing more as you take your findings out on the road and continue to work both as a researcher and an activist scholar. And congratulations on completing this research and participating in the book. And in closing, Prerna Gupta, tell us where we can find this wonderful, illuminating book. It speaks to so many important issues of our time, bringing a lens on radiation exposure and the industry's impacts, and how everyday people carry not only impacts, but histories and insights on the problem. It's called Making the Unseen Visible: Science and the Contested Histories of Radiation Exposure. Where can people find the book?
So this book is published by the Oregon State University Press, and you can find it on their website and purchase it there. It can be internationally shipped.
Good. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the Old Mole Variety Hour here in KBOO today. Prerna Gupta, keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me.